Good evening, everybody. My name's Tim Besley. I'm the director of the Suntory Toyota International Centres for Economics and Related Disciplines, STICRD, as we're known. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the inaugural Michio Morishima Memorial Lecture. Michio, who passed away in 2004, was the founder of STICRD and professor of economics here at the LSE. I'm delighted to extend a particular welcome to Mrs. Yoko Morishima and a number of Michio's friends and family who are here this evening. Michio believed very strongly in putting economics to work for the social good. He also believed in the importance of locating economics in its broader historical and scientific context. Those of us in STICRD try to carry on to this day the vision that he set for us. Now, I know that Michio would have been thrilled, as we all are, to have Amartya Sen here to present this lecture. In fact, it was during one of Amartya's undergraduate lectures that I first heard reference to Michio's work, and so I know firsthand that the admiration is mutual. On a personal note, I should say that it was while listening to Amartya's lectures at Oxford that I first decided to become an economist.
I hope the audience heard that.
Apart from the intellectual connections, Amartya has a long-standing association with STICRD, going back to its foundation more than 20 years ago. Amartya was professor of economics at LSE in the 1970s and remains a senior research associate of STICRD to this day. Now, one always faces a dilemma in introducing Amartya. On the one hand, his work is so influential and well-known that I really could use the cliché that he needs no further introduction. Moreover, to do full justice to his lifetime achievements would probably require an introduction that's longer than his lecture. The long version would certainly catalogue the myriad of honours and achievements, including a Nobel Prize in economics, a university professorship at Harvard, and the mastership of Trinity College, Cambridge. Then there are the fundamental contributions to welfare economics, the study of development and well-being more generally. But I think what sets Amartya apart and makes him particularly appropriate for this occasion is the fact that he's a scholar of immense breadth, having made contributions across the social sciences and humanities. The fact that he's put the human condition at the heart of his work is an inspiration to all of us who've benefited from his many writings. Tonight, he'll lecture under the intriguing title, Economics as a Discipline. Amartya, I'm delighted to welcome you back to the LSE and look forward very much to your lecture.
Thank you.
I feel very privileged indeed to be here and to have the, am I audible? Yeah, to have the opportunity of giving the Michio Morishima Memorial Lecture. And I thank Tim for his kind invitation as well as for his extraordinarily kind words. I won't protest, but I could have. It's a real privilege indeed. Michio Morishima, of course, was an outstanding economist and the finest of human beings. But remembering Michio is also extremely important for me personally, since he was a close friend whose presence and friendship made my own life much richer and whose ideas and values have influenced me greatly. And I'm really very touched that Yoko is here, and it's wonderful to have her in the audience today. Michio Morishima's influences will continue, but we are all tremendously sad that he's no longer here in person, and we cannot see his happy face, talk with him, seek his advice, and experience the energizing effects that conversations with Michio always produced. In the topic that I have chosen for this lecture, which Tim mentioned, Michio Morishima's contributions, that is in the economics as a discipline, were both explicit and implicit. I shall comment a little on both. This is not, of course, meant to be a lecture on Morishima's work, but in the process of discussing the nature of the subject of economics, many of Morishima's ideas would call for specific attention, not just because of the nature of the occasion, but mainly because of the basic importance of Michio's ideas. And I was delighted that Tim quoted me quoting Mitya. He had been a very big influence in my thinking and understanding what economics is about. However, given the personal nature of the occasion, I shall not refrain from invoking some personal recollections also of Mitya in particular, but also of some others with whom Mitya and I both worked at the London School of Economics in the 1970s. I think of Mitya today from the time I first met him in the summer of 1965, when I went to visit him, much as a pilgrim, in Osaka on my way back from Berkeley. I taught at Berkeley during 64-65. I was going back from Berkeley to India and stopped in Osaka and saw him. I think of him also through my wonderful years at the LSE from 1971 onwards. Mitya's presence in the school, along with others including Frank Hahn and Terence Gorman, was of course among the principal attractions that brought me to the LSE in the first place. And finally, I think of the happiness and stimulation of regular conversations with Mitya when I visited Stickard at the LSE regularly over each summer from my new base at Harvard. Stickard is a creation of Mitya, reflecting his ideas and supported by his commitment. And even when I had moved across the Atlantic, it gave me the marvelous opportunity to remain in close touch with the school and with the excellent substantive work of Stickard itself. Perhaps I should say some words also about Mitya's personality, in particular his determination to make people think about problems he felt they should really be thinking about. Let me illustrate the point with a small anecdote, which has the exceptional virtue, as anecdotes go, of being actually true. Sometimes towards the end of my days at All Souls College in Oxford, it would have been 1986, I think, the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Robert Runcie, decided to spend a few months in All Souls for some respite from his normal load of hard work to have the opportunity to think afresh and also, as he told me, to recharge his intellectual batteries. Since Runcie was interested in learning some economics, I had the role of sitting down with him and telling him about what the subject was about and in particular what to read. I should perhaps reveal to you the fact that this godless economist found the chief priest of England to be an altogether staler student of economics. One day, the Archbishop told me that he wanted to know something about the Japanese economy. He was planning to visit Japan, I think. And he inquired whether I could bring him together with someone with that expertise. So I phoned Mitya and asked him whether he would like to have dinner with the Archbishop of Canterbury and talk about the Japanese economy. Mitya responded initially by expressing total disbelief. "Come off it, Amartya," he said. "You and the Archbishop. What do you mean by Archbishop? What is it, tell me, that you really want me to do?" But he eventually took me seriously and agreed to come. And Robert Runcie and I brought Mitya and Yoko to an All Souls dinner as our respective guests. Over dinner, Mitya started to talk with the Archbishop on economics. Not on Japan. For meanwhile, Mitya had decided that the leader of the Church of England ought really to know something about Karl Marx's economics. Since the church often gives the impression of knowing nothing about big ideas, which, if only partly right, continue to move a great many people with whom the church attempts to interact. Morishima, I should explain, for those who do not know it, was quite an expert on Marxian economics as well, in addition to his many other expertise. And indeed, his book, Marx's Economics, A Dual Theory of Value and Growth, is, in my judgment, something of a classic in hard-headed analysis of analytical and technical aspects of the Marxian economic system. So Mitya insisted on lecturing the Archbishop of Canterbury on Marxian economic theory. From circular flows of commodities and capital and the working of reproduction schemes to surplus value, exploitation, and alienation. If I remember right, the circular flow of commodities and capital continued rather energetically through the circulation of port and after-dinner claret. The discussion went on for an hour and a half beyond the dinner, after which Robert Runcie and I walked Yoko and Michio to their car outside the college. Before they left, the Archbishop thanked Michio very warmly. As we walked back, Robert Runcie told me, I quote, "I may not have learned very much about Japan, but I now know a great deal more about Karl Marx than I ever wanted to know." But then he stopped walking and said, "But you know, your friend is absolutely right. I should have learned about all this many years ago." I was particularly impressed that on several occasions in my subsequent conversations with Robert Runcie, the Archbishop invoked what he had just learned from Michio Morishima about Marx's propositions and their partial relevance today. So Michio was completely successful and had started amending the world exactly the way he thought it should be amended. Under the topic of this talk, I would like to comment in particular on two alternative priorities that we find in investigations within our discipline, which I, as I will presently discuss, relate very closely to Morishima's own work and own theorizing about economics. One priority is that of separation, and the focus here is on separating out distinct questions as sharply as possible. An alternative priority is that of integration, whereby we look particularly for the interrelation between distinct issues. The two approaches are not, of course, incompatible. Also, fruitful contributions have been made in economics, both by focusing on separation and on integration. And yet, differences in the relative emphasis between the two can be very important in the way we set up our questions and how we seek to answer them. Indeed, I shall argue that some of the major battles within economics have been particularly concerned with prioritizing separation versus focusing on integration, and these battles can perhaps be better understood in more general terms by considering the advantages and limitations of partitioning problems rigidly and considering them together. It's not hard to understand what the basic motivation behind integration can be. Completeness is sought to fill up a partial picture that separation may yield. But what can be the reasoning behind prioritizing separation? I would argue that there are two important motives that bear on the urge to separate. One is intellectual clarity. When distinct issues get mixed up, they need to be separated. And the other is investigative convenience. Considering all problems together may make the analysis so complex that a fuller understanding of a separated out part of the whole picture may be quite rewarding. Of the two motivations, intellectual clarity may be the more difficult issue to deal with, since what appears to be clarity to some might look like confusion to others. And there would thus be good reason to subject the claims of both sides to close scrutiny. I shall presently discuss some famous examples of programs of separation within the discipline. One of them, namely the insistence on the dichotomy between ethics and economics, is a very important event in the history of economics, and one in the sponsoring of which the LSE played a big part, partly through the philosophical influence of Karl Popper, but mostly through the intellectual work of Lionel Robbins. Another example, the debate between Milton Friedman and Paul Samuelson on the nature of description and prediction, occurred mostly on the other side of the Atlantic. But I remember the interest the subject generated here too, here at LSE, when I was here. However, before I go into the thornier issues of clarity of separation, let me comment briefly on the other motivation behind separation, namely investigative convenience. A good deal of pure economic theory thrives on such separation, both in the form of considering economic models in which parts of the complex reality is kept out for the tractability of what is being analyzed, and in the use of relatively abstract reasoning that looks at some relations between relevant variables while completely ignoring others. I cannot think of an economic theorist who has not used separation in one form or another in his or her investigation, though typically we like our own separation and hate those made by others. And yet questions have been constantly asked about whether the separation was of the right kind and whether too much of the reality was left out. Michio Morishima, in particular, has been engaged in a big way on the issue of separation in his critique of economic theory, particularly in his later years. Let me say a little more about Michio's own academic work, since he began as very much a pure theorist, indeed one of the finest practitioners of that art, and moved later on to a methodological position in which he was very sharply critical of the nature of pure theory flourishing in the discipline of economics. Michio Morishima established a formidable reputation as a supremely skilled economic theorist very early in his life. His book, Equilibrium, Stability and Growth, A Multisectoral Analysis, and other far-reaching books and articles in analytical economics are absolutely classic contributions to the subject. John Hicks, that great economic theorist who was at the LSE first but was later at Oxford, told me that when he read Morishima on multi-sector analysis, he had the irresistible sense that a chaotic cluster of bushes had been made into a flowering garden. Morishima soon had the impeccable reputation of being one of the leading economist theorists of our time. But then his discontent with pure economic theory turned him from the land he had conquered. Eventually he would conquer other lands elsewhere, but his discontent came first. He was concerned with what he saw as the economic theorist's lack of knowledge about the empirical reality about which they theorize, and he found it even more deplorable that this lack of knowledge was clearly connected with a lack of interest in the world beyond the abstracted reality studied in economic theory. He gave eloquent and sharp expression to his discontent in an essay called The Good and Bad Uses of Mathematics. I quote from that essay. "We have in our discipline been led up the wrong path by the invisible hand of the demon. And because it takes time and money to make an engine, we are producing on a large scale aeroplanes which have no engine," unquote. Morishima then proceeded to alter the boundaries of the discipline of economics by raising fresh questions and undertaking novel investigations, taking economics into territories that had been formerly allocated to sociology, anthropology, and history. There came new books with more integrationist priorities and much wider domain of investigation, such as The Economic Theory of Modern Society, a book in which economics and sociology nestle closely together, Why Has Japan Succeeded? Western Technology and Japanese Ethos, which has dual integrational features, in that the contribution of behavioral ethics to economic performance is powerfully investigated, and furthermore, the role of Japanese history in the formation of contemporary Japanese behavioral ethics is also studied. Then Capital and Credit, a new formulation of general equilibrium theory, which brings in some neglected empirical features into the formulation of one of the classic problems of pure theory. And Japan at a Deadlock, which is basically an empirical work, but in which insights from economic theory are extensively used. These works are extraordinarily impressive and undoubtedly important. But we must also ask, what do we think of the works of the earlier Morishima in the light of the achievement and methodological priorities of the later Morishima? Even though Michio was capable of tremendous self-criticism and did not talk much about his early works at all in his later conversations, I don't think he really came to see them as aeroplanes without engine, and they certainly were not that. But what then were they? They were not meant to be aeroplanes at all, but analytical investigations of parts of a more complex story, which could not, of course, fly on their own, but nor were they meant to. The richness of an economy with many sectors producing very diverse goods may be completely lost in more aggregative modeling, including the best of them, like John Maynard Keynes' General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, a classic economic contribution published in 1956, as people would know, and the garden of many flowers, of which John Hicks spoke so admiringly, needed to be produced for a fuller understanding. And that was the multi-sector analysis book to which I'm referring now. And still, a fuller understanding is not, of course, a full understanding. A great many empirical features were still entirely missing in that richer portrayal of the world, and also more inputs were needed from sociology and other related disciplines to fill up many of the missing bits. And yet it's undeniable that this additional extension in multi-sector way of thinking about economics made a major contribution, even with these limitations. I would argue that the right way of understanding the value of both types of work that Morishima had done over his lifetime is to see the first set of contributions to pure theory as important but partial investigations of a complex reality, to be supplemented by bringing in other features that had no room in those partial investigations. We can do justice to the variety of Morishima's works, as well as his later methodological view, not by denouncing either his earlier work, which were basically complete investigations of deliberately separated out partial pictures of an underlying reality, nor by decrying the inescapable complexity, even messiness, of his later works, which were partial investigations of more complex pictures of reality, but by seeing the contingent importance of each. The conclusion I would urge is the simultaneous recognition of the conditional importance of investigations of well-identified partial pictures and of the absolute necessity to see that they cannot be the end product of economics, even of economic theory. The later Morishima's dissatisfaction with the false sense of completed achievement, and indeed the smugness of many pure theorists, did make sense. And he was right to emphasize the need constantly to seek broadening of coverage towards fuller pictures. All the constructive insights that the later Morishima offers become relevant when the exercise of broadening is undertaken. And yet all this does not require us to dismiss the nature of the contribution that the early Morishima made. And many of the contributions that old-fashioned economic theory had made and still makes to our understanding of the world remains relevant. In defense of this latter claim, I offer the fact that even the highly oversimplified general theory of that great abstractionist, John Maynard Keynes, did make a significant difference to public policy. And also the fact that when Michio Morishima was trying to expand the education of the Archbishop of Canterbury, he had no hesitation in bringing in some results from fairly pure Marxian economic theory to the attention of a person with a very powerful voice in the real world. The relation between useful abstraction and underlying reality requires, I would argue, a persistently dual approach. I turn now to the issue of clarity, which is, as I said, intrinsically a more treacherous subject, and in particular to the debate surrounding the postulated dichotomy between ethics and economics. Perhaps the most important contribution, certainly the most influential, in defense of such a dichotomy came from Lionel Robbins, who was a big figure at the LSE, and indeed in the world, and justifiably so. Robbins's separation of ethics from scientific economics in the particularly strong form of there being a real dichotomy there had a profound effect in changing for many decades the nature and acceptability of welfare economics, which tries to draw on both ethics and economics. Given the nature of this lecture and my unwillingness to avoid personal recollections, let me say a little on the personal side as well. I did not know Lionel Robbins personally in my first period of stay in England between 1953 to 63 as a student and then as a young teacher in Cambridge. Though I read a lot of his work and heard a great deal about him personally from Tapas Majumdar, who had done his doctorate with Robbins on utility theory, and from Richard Layard, who had worked with him in the production of the so-called Robbins Report on higher education in Britain. But after my move to the LSE from the Delhi School of Economics in 1971, I had the privilege of coming to know Robbins reasonably well personally. We did not, of course, agree on the particular subject of ethics-economic dichotomy, and this, I fear, is a mild statement. But I was altogether captivated both by Robbins's kindness and generosity and also by the amazing depth of his understanding of the history of economic thought. I also remember with great fondness one occasion at which Robbins, it was over a lunch actually, it began over a lunch and went on, wanted me to read an article by William Baumol, who had been at the school much earlier, an article in which Baumol had argued that I had misinterpreted a particular remark of Lionel Robbins completely. I was especially amused by the hesitation with which Lionel Robbins asked me whether I ever had the occasion to read any of William Baumol's writings. Happily, I was able to assure my new friend that I did, and that on this occasion, as in others, Baumol was absolutely right. I did make exactly the mistake that Baumol thought I had. I shall come to the content of that issue presently, but I must also note the fact that there followed that afternoon a remarkable conversation in which Lionel Robbins tried to convince me that I had not in fact made any serious mistake at all. It was rather the poor way in which he himself had worded his proposition. I remember thinking that I would give almost anything to come anywhere close to acquiring Lionel Robbins's immense grace. On the subject of the status of welfare economics, which combined ethics and economics, Robbins had initially been, in the 1930s, very firm and uncompromising. He would have none of the purity of economics, sullied by the introduction of ethical issues that he argued were not open to scientific examination. Indeed, Robbins was clearly tempted by the view that normative propositions about good and bad were simply, quote-unquote, meaningless. This was happening in the 1930s, which were, we must remember, the heyday of a particularly narrow view of positivist philosophy. The dominant understanding of a meaningful proposition then was, to summarize at the risk of some oversimplification, to have meaning, a proposition must be unambiguously refutable, or as Karl Popper would put it, falsifiable. Mainstream philosophy, however, soon moved, to a considerable extent influenced by Ludwig Wittgenstein's later works, out of that peculiarly restrictive philosophical hole which made most normal conversations look nonsensical. But even as philosophers were busy discussing the rules that we follow in making ourselves understood and how the conventions of language make the meaning of sentences of different types clear for mutual comprehension, economists remained stuck for many decades in the quagmire of positivist non-comprehension. However, Robbins himself was quite open-minded about all this when I talked with him. He told me, in the very same conversation and also in some other occasions, that he was really much more concerned with distinguishing between the two disciplines, the discipline of verifiable economic propositions and that of ethics, that is, the exercise of separation. And he did not intend to deny the legitimacy of ethics or welfare economics in any way. This was, in fact, closely related to the subject on which Baumol had corrected me, since I had claimed, wrongly, that Robbins had dismissed interpersonal comparisons of utilities, which was the informational basis of standard welfare economics, as being inadmissible. But Baumol was entirely right, and so was Robbins, that he was rather asserting a dichotomy between speculative ethics and scientific economics, and he saw interpersonal comparisons as belonging to the former, that is, ethical speculations, not the latter, descriptive economics. I don't think this is right either, for reasons that many, like Ian Little, the economist, and philosophers like Donald Davidson and Alan Gibbard and others, have argued. But this is a side issue in the context of the general thesis of the possibility of dichotomizing ethics and economics, and I'll presently discuss a bit later as to why it's so much of a side issue. In examining the thesis of a dichotomy, we have to see how a dichotomy differs from a mere distinction. There can hardly be any doubt that ethics is a different subject from economics. Indeed, unless we see that distinction first, we cannot even sensibly ask, how does ethics relate to economics? A dichotomy, rather, is a diagnosis of a parting of ways, that is, of going in different directions entirely independently of each other. An analogy can be found in the parting of ways about which Robert Frost speaks in his poem, The Road Not Taken. I quote from Frost. Two roads diverge in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Lionel Robbins presented his thesis of dichotomy in a particularly strong form. I quote from Robbins now. It does not seem logically possible to associate the two studies, ethics and economics, in any form but mere juxtaposition, unquote. The undermining of the standing of ethical questions in economics, as presented by Robbins and his followers, did raise some interesting and serious issues. But the initial debate got mixed up with what was, in this context, really a different issue, as I shall presently discuss and already mention, namely whether interpersonal comparisons of utility could be objective. This happened because the primary, indeed the only well-developed theory of welfare economics, was at that time utilitarianism, which had to rely on comparing the utilities of different persons to arrive at welfare economic judgments for society as a whole. So the undermining of the informational basis of utilitarian economics appeared to many to be much the same as the undermining of welfare economics altogether. Robbins invoked Jevons in finding, I quote, no means whereby such comparison can be accomplished, unquote. New quote from Robbins again. Every mind is inscrutable to every other mind, and no common denominator of feelings is possible, unquote. Since economists came largely to be convinced that there was indeed something methodologically wrong in using interpersonal comparisons of utilities, the fuller version of the utilitarian tradition soon gave way in the 1940s, 50s, and continuing into the 60s, to a kind of mutilated utilitarianism, what came to be known as the new welfare economics. This largely took the form of continuing to rely on utilities only, an exclusive reliance that sometimes goes by the name of welfareism, but to dispense with interpersonal comparisons altogether, relying instead only on what is called Pareto comparison, in which a social state is taken to be better than another if everyone had more utility in the first than in the second, or at least everyone has at least as much and some person has more. But welfareism, that is relying only on utility information without interpersonal comparison of utilities, is in fact a very restrictive informational basis for welfare judgments and makes it particularly difficult to make distributional judgments. Then came a further reason for gloom. Kenneth Arrow, who in his early work remained confined to doing without any interpersonal comparison, following Robbins's lead, soon showed in a mathematical result of breathtaking elegance and interest that social choice could not simultaneously satisfy some very minimal conditions of reasonableness. This impossibility theorem was taken by some to be the final disposal of welfare economics. Welfare economics was told the bell tolls for thee. The impossibility theorem, however, is reversed if we make room for interpersonal comparisons of utility or interpersonal comparisons of whatever other indicators of individual advantage are taken as the informational basis of social judgments. I personally got very caught up in all this, and my book, Collective Choice and Social Welfare, published in 1970, the year before I moved to the LSE, was much concerned with incorporating different ways of making interpersonal comparisons and their far-reaching consequences on what is permissible in welfare economics. I was very privileged that there was soon quite a team of social choice theorists: Hammond, Strassnick, Gevers, D'Apremo, Maskin, Sudomura, Blackaby, Donaldson, Waymark, Roberts, and others, including Arrow himself, who worked on this aspect of welfare economics with richer information. Charles Blackaby was in fact at the LSE itself in those days. We soon knew many new ways of having constructive welfare economics. Once the total ban on interpersonal comparison of utilities or of individual welfare had been removed. Meanwhile, in related fields, James Merlies was resolving central issues on optimal taxation, Tony Atkinson was sorting out problems in the measurement of inequality, and so on, using extensive interpersonal comparisons. All this was very useful for constructive welfare economics. But as far as the foundational doubts about the link between ethics and economics are concerned, the nature of interpersonal comparison is surely an entirely irrelevant issue. Even if it is accepted that interpersonal comparisons can be partially or fully done, and even if it is added that all this can be very objective indeed, there would surely still be the question about the ethical status of social choice conditions that are involved in using factual utility information in making ethical judgments in welfare economics. There is a need for a traverse. And an exactly similar question will arise in this framework, even if we use any other informational basis for ethical judgment for society other than utility, such as liberty or capability or whatever. The reach of Robbins's claim about the dichotomy between ethics and economics was very large indeed. And as far as the foundational claim is concerned, no real difference is made by whether we think interpersonal comparison of utilities to be scientific or not in that vision. But is that vision of a dichotomy correct? I wonder. The dichotomy can hardly work if it is taken strictly. Descriptive and predictive economics are very concerned with human behavior, and the behavior of human beings are certainly influenced by a variety of motivations, in which ethics can hardly fail to figure. It is, of course, true that in mainstream economics, the assumption of the thoroughly self-centered and self-interested human beings, completely free from ethics, have had a lot of erring. And the mythical hero, whom I have taken the liberty of calling the rational fool, my first attempt at adding this insult to injury, was in my inaugural lecture in this very hall in 1972. That rational fool has been romping around vigorously in parts of pure economic theory, and more recently trying to take over the new subject of rational choice politics and law and economics. But that assumption has had little corroboration from observations of actual behavior in the real world, including Mitchell's, in the economic or in any other field. And it has been also extensively contradicted more recently in the observations of experimental games such as the ultimatum game. Ethics seem to have a habit of creeping into the behavior of human beings, making it difficult to make good predictions of human behavior without taking note of ethical concerns. Michio Morishima's book, Why Has Japan Succeeded? Western Technology and Japanese Ethos, published in 1984, to whom I referred earlier, discusses, among other things, how extensive can be the influence of an ethos on economic success. And it is difficult to see a dichotomy here if it is meant to keep ethical issues out of the subject matter of descriptive or predictive economics. It could, however, be said that discussing the influence of ethical belief is not the same thing as discussing ethics. But there is also a more philosophical question that needs to be addressed in dealing with the thesis of this dichotomy. That question has recently been very forcefully presented and discussed by Hilary Putnam in his illuminating book, The Collapse of the Fact-Value Dichotomy and Other Essays, published in 2002. I'm not going to attempt a summary of the epistemological of this epistemological work by one of the leading philosophers of our time, Hilary Putnam, but I must emphasize the importance of seeing the difference between a distinction and a dichotomy. The collapse of a fact-value dichotomy is a thesis not about whether a distinction can be somehow made between facts and values. There are lots of ways of doing it. But about whether there is a plausible parting of ways, in Robert Frost's sense here. In particular, a dichotomy is seriously compromised by what Putnam called entanglements. Morishima's discussion of the role of ethics in observable economic success illustrates one kind of entanglement. But there is the more pervasive phenomena of the common inclination to move smoothly from observational statements to clearly valuational conclusions, aided by conventions of communication, including things about abject poverty, terrible tortures, violation of basic freedoms of various kinds. As Vivian Walsh, an economist also interested in philosophy, has remarked, commenting on Putnam's argument, I quote, "While the phrase entanglement of fact and value is a convenient shorthand, what we are typically dealing with, as Putnam makes clear, is a triple entanglement of fact, convention, and value," unquote. You might note, some people might note the Wittgensteinian error in that. I've discussed elsewhere the issue of triple entanglement rather less rapidly than I shall have to do tonight, since my time would be running out. But given the relevance of the subject to tonight's topic, I will draw briefly on what I have tried to say elsewhere. That is in an article that I did in the Review of Political Economy, which I think came out in 2005. Consider the demand that justice should not only be done, but must also be seen to be done. An admonition that has received ringing endorsement and approving reiteration right from the time it was first uttered by Lord Hewitt in 1923 in Rex versus Sussex Justices, articulating an insistence that justice, I quote from Hewitt, should manifestly and undoubtedly be seen to be done, unquote. Some of the reasons for attaching importance to the need for a decision to be seen to be just may well be instrumental. For one thing, the administration of justice can in general be more effective if judges are seen to be doing a good job rather than botching things up. And yet it is hard to dismiss the suspicion that something more than the instrumental importance of the visibility of justice is involved in Hewitt's maxim. If others, not charged with dispensing justice, cannot even see that a judgment is just, then not only its implementability and instrumental use, but even its correctness, its status, would seem to be called into question. There would seem to be a deeper connection between veracity and visibility in matters of justice, something of a triple entanglement of fact, convention, and value. Let me illustrate the point with the variation of one part of his story I presented in my longer assessment of this question. So I give you this story. It's not about economics, by the way. Elsie is walking along the embankment near Aldwych, quietly enjoying the smooth-flowing Thames, thinking about what she has just learned in her class on the methodology of social science. In particular, why value judgments are altogether distinct from facts and could not be derived from facts. Her train of engaging thought is pleasingly interrupted when Elsie runs into an old friend who has such an odd name. Elsie has always been amused by it. His name is Vienna Circle. Vienna is a meteorologist at the Met Office. "Nice day, Vienna," says Elsie. "But what kind of a day for tomorrow are you predicting?" "A silly thing to discuss, my dear Elsie," replies Vienna. "But since you ask me, let me tell you that I think tomorrow's weather will be much, much better than today's. In fact, it will be marvelously good." Elsie goes home happy and dusts up her bike for a long ride on the heat for the next day. But in waking up next morning, when Elsie sees through her window a very dark day with massive rain and messy mist, she is very upset and calls up Vienna Circle. "Why did you lie to me, Vienna? Or does the Met Office get everything wrong?" "Elsie," says Vienna, "I said I think it's going to be marvelously good, and my God, it is, I think, marvelously good. Lovely wetness and grand darkness." "But Vienna," shouts Elsie, "just look outside. You can see it is simply a nasty day. Ask anyone." "How can looking help?" replies Vienna. "Don't you even know, my silly girl, that a valuational issue is not resolvable by factual observations? You must understand that nasty, good, better are normative terms, not matters of fact, nor matters of seeing and observation. Dear, dear Elsie, you really ought to learn some philosophy, a great subject, very popular at the Met Office." Elsie cannot help pondering on the fact that even though good, nasty, better are evaluative terms, it's not hard to understand why they are so firmly linked to things one can see. It's not only that people by and large agree on these uses, but also understand well enough why agreements emerge so easily on such subjects. The rules connect with our experiences and priorities, and even though they need not follow from facts alone, they're reasonably obvious rules to internalize, given the kind of creatures we human beings are. For example, how adversely affected physically and mentally we typically are by wetness, slipperiness, messiness, and darkness. Elsie wants to bark all this out to Vienna, but he had meanwhile hung up, presumably in his gallant attempt not to cause further embarrassment to ignorant Elsie. In the original and longer version of the story, in that article in the Review of Political Economy, Elsie would have further adventures with other examples of normative judgment entangled with descriptive statements. The most immediate conclusion to emerge from all this is, of course, that Elsie does need some new friends. But perhaps there is also a less immediate communication here about the need to take note of triple entanglement and the role of internalized valuation, which throw some light on Elsie's problems with Vienna Circle at the Met Office and the others she would meet later on in the fuller version of the story, which I haven't told you. Vienna's problems have similarities with the communicational issues in economics and other social studies, dealing, for example, with the outrage at gross inequality, abject poverty, bone-crushing exploitation, and the torture of helpless victims. The thesis of dichotomy, that ethics and economics are really unlinked except through juxtaposition, had great difficulty, both for Morishima's reasons, the predictive lacuna in ignoring ethos and ethics, and for Putnam's, the comprehensional difficulties in ignoring entanglement of values, observation, and our normal communication. I turn finally, and very briefly given the time, to the Friedman-Samuelson debates on description and prediction. In his thesis about the nature of positive economics, Friedman argued that description has to be parasitic on prediction, with no standing of its own, shorn of reflective, predictive success. Pursuing this line of thought, Friedman called that even quote-unquote realism, that great descriptive virtue, I quote, would have to be judged by seeing whether the theory works, which means whether it yields sufficiently accurate predictions, unquote. This is, in fact, a very special view of descriptive realism, and not surprisingly, it has been powerfully criticized by Paul Samuelson and others. Samuelson called it the F-twist, not quite flatteringly, I should explain. Indeed, it seems very difficult to think, very strange indeed, that we cannot be interested in such descriptive questions as, has unemployment increased, or has inflation slowed down, without bringing in some ulterior predictive propositions underlying the subject of discussion. To be sure, there are other apparently descriptive statements that contain implicit predictive understanding. A good example of that would be that a statement like the market is in equilibrium, which seems to describe the market as it is. But in order to check whether the claim is true, we have to ascertain, among other things, whether the firms could have earned more profits or consumers could have satisfied their preferences better by following different policies, a counterfactual exercise, given the prices and the markets, than what we observe they have actually chosen. Such counterfactual prediction would be implicit in the idea of equilibrium in game theory as well, like the characterization of Nash equilibrium, which requires us to check whether anyone could have done better by following different policies than the one we see her doing, given the policies of everyone else. The possibility of implicit predictive content in apparently pure description is certainly worth acknowledging. But after acknowledging that, it would be sheer predictive imperialism if you go on from there to insist that every descriptive proposition must have a predictivist reduction. If you are interested in checking whether inflation has come down or not, we are definitely looking at price changes today compared with the past. And it would be silly to mix that up, that piece of legitimate epistemics up, either with what would happen in the future or with the counterfactual prediction of what would have happened had different things been done. Things sometimes are exactly as they seem. So my first point on the predictive-descriptive relation is that while descriptive propositions can contain implicit predictions, they need not invariably do so. This takes me towards a more Samuelsonian position than the Friedmanite view, And I have to confess that I share Samuelson's strong belief, as did Michio, that realism is an important descriptive virtue in economics, along with other virtues of which predictive success is one, but only one. I would, however, go a bit further and argue that an exactly converse claim to Friedman's can plausibly be made, certainly more plausibly than Friedman's own claims. And this claim, my second point, concerns the content of prediction and its inescapable dependence on description. When we examine whether a prediction is accurate, to use Friedman's focus of attention, what is it that we are trying to do? The accuracy of a prediction is surely a congruence of what we prognosticate will happen with what actually ends up happening. But what actually happens is a matter of description, and it would be rather bizarre to think that we can check the accuracy of a prediction without any idea of a descriptive truth. To come back to the example of inflation, consider the prediction that if some policies are followed, such as money supply is reduced, then the rate of inflation will decline. To check whether we got this right, we must at some stage have to examine whether what is predicted under those conditions about the inflation rate does actually occur. But to do this, there surely must be some idea of descriptive accuracy, even an idea of a descriptive reality, and this has to come before the concept of predictive accuracy can be entertained. This is such an elementary point that I must confess to feeling a little embarrassed in having to make it, but the need to make arises from the evident attempt to make description parasitic on prediction, not the other way around, which is peculiarly difficult to understand, not to mention defend. So there is a need for a directional integration here, the integration here certainly, but the direction, I would argue, is exactly the opposite of the one postulated by Friedman. But debates aside, I leave Friedman and Samuelson there, the important issue for the discipline of economic concerns the extensive interdependencies between description, prediction, and prescription. Not that these distinctions don't exist. Fact-value distinction may well also exist, but it's the question of whether to what extent you can fruitfully dichotomize. No one understood the interconnection better than my friend Michio Morishima. The fact that intelligently thought out separation for investigative convenience can work and make significant contribution to our understanding of the complex real world is not the issue here. It certainly can, as Morishima's own work, particularly his early work, shows. But ultimately, we have to take fuller note of the interconnections and the demands of integration, precisely as Michio Morishima suggested. I end by expressing my deep appreciation for what Michio Morishima taught us, and by paying homage once again to my wonderful friend who is missed by us all. Thank you.
A short while for some questions. Because of the popularity of this lecture, it's being relayed to another room in the school. So it's important that people speak into the microphone, and I will ask Amartya to repeat the question before he gives the answer in case people in the other room in particular didn't get it. I would like to take the first question. I ask you to keep them brief, please, and then thereafter we'll try and let Amartya self-regulate, and at a certain time I'll have to call time because there is a deadline at the other end. Anyway, I'm throwing the floor open now for the first question. So just wait for the microphone to get there.
Professor Sen?
Yes. That was an easy question to answer.
Is that better? Okay. I understand that at Cambridge you had the opportunity to take a DPhil in philosophy as well as economics, and that has
I took.
Yes, that you studied philosophy as the result of a fellowship, when finished with your study of economics. I was wondering, what would you take now to supplement your understanding of economics?
Yeah, it's a good question, but it's based on a false empirical premise. And in the sense that I did not do a DPhil in philosophy in Cambridge. I was fortunate to have a kind of fellowship in Trinity initially for 4 years, which gave me complete freedom to do what I liked. And since I was quite lucky and got some, you know, moderately possible results to complete my PhD rather rapidly, I had some time to kill. And I thought, since I was always interested in philosophy, in fact started studying philosophy at home, as it were, well before I started economics, because I began in my late school and early college days with maths and physics, and then moved to economics. But philosophy I knew already somewhat, not many people, but a few of my chosen authors. But what I did was to, you're right, I was tutored to some extent. We had a very fine philosopher in Trinity called C.D. Broad at that time, whom I liked, who detested my politics, but quite liked me individually, and gave me good tutorials about what I should really study and read. And they were very helpful to me. So that's what I did. So that's the empirical bit. But your question isn't about that, of course, what one should do now. I think this is where the catalysity that Michio was beginning to was bringing into economics is quite important here, namely that there are many related disciplines. We don't have to become an expert in anthropology, in sociology, in history, in order to do economics well. But we ought to know a great deal more than we do about these things. So I would have taken a leaf from Michio's book and did what he himself did, he told me. He studied quite a lot of, featured quite a lot of writings in these fields to, as it were, retool himself to broaden. And I will be, once again, a follower of Michio in this way. By the way, I had failed to repeat the question. I know that normally that's not the right order to tell the question after the answer. But I hope you guessed what the question was on the basis of the answer. That's the kind of quiz. We will have a test later on that.
Right, next question. One up at the back there.
Hi, Mr. Sen. Slightly normative question.
Yep. Where are you? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Do you think the spread of democracy has a role in encouraging development, or is economics the sole way to encourage development? Thanks.
It's a very interesting question, whether the spread of democracy has had the role of encouraging development or the reverse. It's a very interesting question, because first of all, we have to ask, what does development mean? What does it contain as elements? Now, if you took the view that democracy is about political freedom, whereas development is about something else, like rise of GNP or economic freedom only, then of course the question does not have any constitutive component. It's only a causal connection we're looking at. Does one kind of freedom, political freedom, multi-party democracy gives, freedom of speech, freedom to criticize, freedom to vote, freedom to throw government out of office, whether that encourages other kind of freedom, freedom from want, freedom from economic necessities. Now, development can be characterized in different ways, but I've tried to argue that ultimately the motivation behind development lies in expansion of human freedom. And if that's the case, very difficult to see that development is really only about economic freedom and not also about all other kinds of freedom, social opportunities and political freedom as well. So, you know, if you are very rich and have no physical want, but the moment you say something, you'll be arrested, and the government that rules you, you disapprove of, you cannot say anything about it, nor you have an opportunity to vote against it. I would have thought in some ways development has passed you by, not in the way of your economic needs being fulfilled, but in other ways. So I would first say that there is a constitutive component in it. But the second, and that has been the subject of a book of mine called Development as Freedom, and that argues, this is an empirical proposition and not watertight, but I think broadly true, that freedom of different kinds are mutually supportive. In fact, the bulk of the book provides evidence of that as to why political freedom has tended to encourage economic freedom, while social opportunities have encouraged political freedom as well as economic freedom, while economic freedom in turn has encouraged these other things. So in that context, the spread of democracy I have to see as being contribution also to other types of freedom and not just what it intrinsically, definitionally contained, namely political freedom. When India was having very low rate of economic growth, this kind of question that you asked me would be always supplemented by saying, you see, how do you comment on the fact that India is a democracy and having such low rates of growth, isn't it the case that it indicates that democracy tends to reduce your growth rate? Now, there was never particular evidence in that direction anyway. This is just selective evidence comparing India with Singapore or South Korea, but not with Afghanistan, Somalia, or North Korea. But also, now that India is going quite fast and nothing has changed as far as democracy is concerned, it's exactly as democratic today as it had been before, which is not meaning perfect democracy, but pretty good try, 8 out of 10, I say. And that remains about 8 out of 10 today, but the growth rate has gone up. So that seemed to confirm the view which I presented in the book, that economic growth depends on the friendliness of the economic climate, not the fierceness of the political climate. And when you think about the reasoning behind that, it's not hard to see why that is the case. But no one now gives India as an example, since there's all this hype going on about India's high rate of growth and about to be taking over this, that, another, which I think is overhyped. But one result of the hype is that question has disappeared from my normal Q&A routine, which I have always dealt with, and I miss it. Feel quite nostalgic.
Back there.
Hi, Professor Sen. It's really inspiring to hear you speak. Thanks you for coming to the LSE.
Thank you.
I have a two-part question. The first is, as a South Asian who came here to England, did you encounter any resistance during your early years at Oxbridge, both as a student and as you were teaching and publishing? And the second part is this. Nowadays, I think after the July terrorist attacks here in England, there's been the question of whether it's necessary for people to become more acculturated here in England to you know, expose themselves more to other cultures, whether they have the freedom to remain secluded. And also, a lecturer of mine was telling me how there's now a law in the Netherlands that that would make it illegal to speak foreign languages in public. And I think these are two related things. What do you feel about the state of racism today? What do you feel about gender inequality and the like?
Well, to begin answering the last question, I feel pretty bad about them. They're terrible things, the continuation of gender inequality, class inequality, and other kinds of inequality. So I think you're quite right to focus on it. The question was twofold. It was that one, that when I first came here, as a young man, as a South Asian, did I encounter resistance and discrimination personally myself? And secondly, now that the issue of immigration has become very widespread and it's also connected with such issues as so-called war against terrorism, you didn't use the word, but that's often used in this context, and various things are done in its name. How do we deal with that question? And in particular, I think there was some reference that somewhere it's become declared illegal to speak in public in foreign language. I hadn't heard. It's not in Britain, is it? No. I thought I was going to try it just outside Aldwych. But whenever that happens, I think it's easy to say that it's a terrible thing. Coming to the first question, I actually was quite lucky. I don't think I ever had anything that I detected as clear expression of racism or discrimination of that kind. People did sometimes comment on my propositions, my inability to conduct myself properly. I think I remember one occasion going up the Kentish Town escalator, swinging my briefcase, and I got a gentleman on his knees. And after falling down, he told me, "Go back to Pakistan." But I decided that there was some provocation for that. So I personally am very lucky, but I shouldn't dismiss the question, because there were a lot of people I know who did have discrimination, who did have bad experiences, not so much in Oxford, but particularly in parts of London. And a friend of mine was actually beaten up in a lonely evening thing. So I think my personal experience, I've been lucky. The second thing is that I think we have to really think about the existence and our identities in this context. I'm very liable to go on for hours on this subject because I've just finished a book which will come out in March called Identity and Violence, The Illusion of Destiny, published by Norton there, and will be published by Penguin here in July. Yeah, the English take their time, because by the time that comes, the American edition, the Indian edition, the Japanese edition, the Chinese edition, the Korean edition would all have come out, but the English will then enter the fray in July. But I'm looking forward to that, because I will be able to be present at that time, which is rather nice to happen in sponsoring that book. But I'm quite excited about it, and I really enjoyed the previous occasion when I had to present a book here. That was the book on India, The Argumentative Indian. And this one, it will be about the question that you ask: how do we look at our identity? And I take the view that I think something rather deeply wrong has happened to the way multiculturalism is understood in this country. Multiculturalism is, to me, not having separate schools for Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, paid for by the government. Multiculturalism is old Brits in old schools learning also something about the Arab heritage in mathematics, not just their Islamic beliefs. Some reminder that when anyone at LSE or the Imperial College uses algorithm, the word algorithm, he's commemorating the name of the Muslim Arab mathematician of 9th century, Al-Khwarizmi, from whose book, Al-Jabr wa Muqabila, the term algebra is derived. What is needed is a different kind of departure. Not that you are Hindu, you study your Hinduism, you're Muslim, you study your Muslim. That seemed to me to be a kind of plural monoculturalism, as opposed to multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, to me, is interaction of various kinds. And that being the case, I think, I really do think something has gone wrong. And actually, U.S. and American policy, the French, something else went wrong. Namely, they tried to do integration, but both of an imposition kind on one side. And the other is what the British did, and this is a praise that needs to be said, particularly following Lord Scammon's report, the Scammon Committee report in 1981, is to make sure that there's hardly any discrimination. There are some still, but very little, in policing, in the distribution of social service benefits and national health service. And of course, the great benefaction that Commonwealth gives to Britain from that point of view is, since Commonwealth citizens vote on arrival as a resident in this country, that means nearly all the colored population that moved to this country, whether from West Indies, West Africa, East Africa, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, or Malaysia, had vote immediately on arrival. They were not defranchised in a way that people in France and Germany remained for a long time, which is why I don't really expect the kind of alienation that fired the French riots in the autumn could happen here. And yet, the other kind, whereby people remaining very distant, this is almost the other side. It's not the opposite, but it's really not doing integration in a multicultural way, and thinking of integration in the form of separate schools, and also the voice of religious groups, much greater now than it ever been. A Bangladeshi Muslim and a Pakistani Muslim had one identity, Muslim identity. Bangladesh happened to separate from Pakistan because of secular priorities and pride in language, literature, and politics. All that gone because of this unifocal concern with culture, civilization, religion. And the schools are all also organized that way, increasingly, in fact, encouraging people to have schools of that kind. Seems to me to go off the wrong way altogether. And it has a lot. I wouldn't say that terrorism necessarily is connected, but it's certainly a situation in which religious priests have a big voice is not particularly a good situation, a good way of discouraging violence that takes off from religion. It's not just a question of stopping the extremist mullahs and replacing them by mild mullahs and moderate imams across the country. It's also a question of making sure that rather than British Muslims being invited on the day after the 7th of July rather than being invited to act within the Muslim community to get their act together, to invite British Muslims to participate in the civil society much more. That's the direction that seems to me a proper multiculturalism as opposed to plural monoculturalism would take me. So I'm very glad you asked the question. Thank you.
Okay, I have one question.
We live in a globalized world in which I think is a perceived wisdom, particularly in respect to China, that politics follows economics. And thus far that has not happened. That's one aspect of what I want to ask. The other aspect is we live in a very polarized situation where China has become the great producer, America has become the great consumer, and the two are linked. And some people talk about a correction to that. I just wanted to ask what you felt about any potential change in politics following economics in China. And also, I guess there is no doubt that the welfare of the common man has improved as the economics have improved. But what impact will there be on welfare if there is a significant readjustment?
Yeah, I think the questions were, to repeat them, one is that, and slightly shorten them, is that the, if I get the summary wrong, you have to correct me, that the received wisdom has been that that politics follows economics. So if China has economic progress, then democracy cannot be far behind. And the questioner remarked that that doesn't seem to have happened so far. What comment? And then also that China has become so unequally large and important, seem to be producing so much more and more of goods in the world, and America seemed to have become a specialist consumer. And so China produces, America consumes, a kind of division of labor, which seemed to be very peculiar. Now, I'm quite used to very odd division of labor, some of which I profited from. When I was working at Stickard, we produced about, I think, 3 or 4 books I produced along with my colleague and friend Jean Drez. And we had a lovely division of labor by which he did 99% of the work and I took 99% of the credit. And that worked out all right. But I think this division of labor may be very hard to sustain the production and consumption. But I think that, I'm answering the second question first, that is probably not entirely correct, because if you look at it, I think China is doing fantastically well. But its role in the world is somewhat over-exaggerated. I think its production in gross domestic product of the world is still less than 5%. Its contribution to trade is still less than 7%. It's more than twice that of India, which is also growing. And soon you'll be hearing complaints about the two together. And you already hear it to some extent. But I think that fear is exaggerated. I think that I see absolutely no. I mean, I ought to confess that despite my left-wing politics, I've always regarded globalization to be an extremely good thing. And it's just a question of making sure that the fruits of globalization are fairly shared. And that's the question of a particular direction of globalization, sometimes indeed more globalization. But I would say that the fear that the kind of asymmetry is developing, I think is somewhat exaggerated. And indeed, the world really benefits a lot from Chinese economic growth. I certainly do. There are lots of commodities I have. My table is full of. I mean, the Indians produce all these rather abstract things, like information technology and pharmaceuticals. And I guess I shouldn't blame the fact that I haven't been ill enough to make good use of the pharmaceuticals. But my table has little computers, little calculators, some very humble things like staplers, all of them made in China, and pretty cheap. And so I think one doesn't have to be a pre-market freak to appreciate that there are some benefits that come from it, too. So I'm really quite laid back on that, and I think on the first question is a subject not to be laid back. But I think the whole thesis that politics follows from economics, I think, is entirely mistaken. There's very little evidence of that. If you think about one of the most successful cases of economic advancement, namely Singapore, is not more liberal today than it was earlier. Hong Kong is not more liberal today than it was earlier in terms of certainly freedom of expression and no possibility of fearing that. I think we have to really give politics its due weight, and therefore, since I regard democracy to be a very important component of human freedom, I think that we are right to agitate about it. I think the Chinese are very concerned too. I have to say I was touched by the fact that Development of Freedom was published in 2 editions, one in Mandarin and one is simplified Chinese translation. And there was some initial attempt at cutting out things, but I insisted none, and none was cut, so that anyone can read what I said about China and its lack of democracy in the book, published by Renmin University Press. The can't get more official than that. That was the simplified Chinese version, and the Chinese were among the first publishers to make an offer on the identity and violence book, which also discusses this issue somewhat, and I think probably will publish it fairly soon, because I gathered that the translation already proceeded. So I think there's a lot of interest inside China. So I'm optimistic, but that's not because of, I think, economic progress will bring it. I think human beings will bring it, and I think human beings have the commitment in China and elsewhere to do just that.
Right. I think with due apologies to the many people who haven't had a chance to get in, I'm afraid I will have to draw it to a close. And can I ask you not to give space for Amartya to leave, because we do have to move on to the next proceeding. So instead of thronging the front, if I can persuade you to clear a passage for him in a moment. But before that happens, I should thank Amartya for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you. And for the distant voices, thank them too.